Welcome everyone to the 25th episode of the Greater European Talks. Today I have with me a voice you may have heard from earlier, Timothy Elbessar. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, am I?
Yes, that's correctly pronounced. Thank you, Philippe. I'm glad to be back.
And he joins us today not only in his formal capacity as a writer, but as a member of the Institute, but also now as a recently appointed chair of EU Asia Pacific Studies. So Timothy, can you tell us a little bit about what that is and how that fits into the Institute's overall work?
Yes, this chair is in fact a sort of think tank within the think tank that is devoted to the study of the EU's strategic interests and relations with Asia-Pacific countries. And so we're aiming at publishing some research papers, policy briefs, and also podcasts in order to cover the whole of the current news in the Asia-Pacific region and provide some good reflection upon it for the European Union's interests and policies.
Fantastic. And of course, if anyone wants to get involved in this, please do check out the new section on the website on our Chair of Studies. We are looking to open potentially other Chair of Studies at the Institute. So if you're interested and particularly motivated, and we highly encourage those, of course, from a minority and female background, do reach out to us and we would love to work in collaboration with this. However, without further ado, we'll move on to the main topic of this, which is, of course, last week. And I believe it was almost exactly 7 days ago.
Yes, it was on February the 1st.
Exactly. It was the coup by the Burmese, or some people call it Myanmar, generals. So, Timothy, can you explain a little bit what happened, why, and what's been the reaction since?
Yes, in fact, the military seized power in the morning and they detained Aung San Suu Kyi, who was the country's former state councillor. This coup, which was led by General Ming Aung Hlaing, seized power because they actually called the November elections fraudulent. In these elections, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, the National League for Democracy, basically picked up 396 out of 477 available seats in parliament, which roughly amounts to 83% of the seats. And so obviously the military called for irregularities because they think that this civilian power would threaten their own power. And they decided to stage this coup in order to defend the country's integrity and constitution. That's what they said. And they had already warned, in fact, that they might take action if Burma's election commission did not proceed with further investigation regarding the results of the elections. And so what now? The army has nominated Vice President Main Sui as the acting president. And the military has released about 400 people due to international pressure, including some National League for Democracy lawmakers. But Aung San Suu Kyi still remains in custody. And coup leader Min Aung Hlaing said that he would revamp the election commission. He also said that he would guarantee a free and fair vote once the state of emergency that was enacted last week expires. And, well, actually, at the present moment, the National League for Democracy and Aung San Suu Kyi's popularity can lead us to believe that these free elections are somewhat of an illusion regarding the lack of the military's popularity, the military that we call Tatmadaw in Burma. So you asked about the reactions. Well, it's quite mixed. If we take into account internal reactions, I came across many times with the terms of grief and disbelief. The National League for Democracy, in accordance with Aung San Suu Kyi's Buddhist and Gandhi principles of nonviolence, the NLD has urged the people to reject the coup in a nonviolent way. Nevertheless, this reach has been somewhat curbed by the military power, since it has blocked access several times, blocked access to Facebook and social media. And we obviously have, of course, some people that support the military, but there's been quite a lot of cases of peaceful civil disobedience, most notably the medical staff in about 70 or 100 hospitals all over the country that staged a strike, and also some Yangon residents and residents all over the country that banged pots and pans, which is a practice that is traditionally associated with exorcising the devil. So that's for internal reactions. International reactions mixed as well, because we have, on the one hand, the United States, the European Union, or G7 countries that condemned the coup and that called for the Tatmadaw to end the state of emergency, restore power to the democratically elected government, and also release Aung San Suu Kyi. But we have, on the other hand, China, for instance, or Russia, which happened to be Myanmar's backers at the UN Security Council, they have called, especially China, they have called this coup a matter of internal affairs that rule out any exterior meddling or crisis solving. And I think that the most interesting set of reaction is in the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, the ASEAN, because we can find three types of reactions. We have some sort of classical reactions by authoritarian regimes such as Cambodia and Thailand, which have basically echoed China's position. Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen, for instance, has refused to comment. We also have some other reactions by Singapore, Malaysia, or Indonesia, which have expressed grave concerns, especially Malaysia and Indonesia, since they're Muslim-majority countries, and that the military that has taken power in Burma is the very same branch of the military that has perpetrated the Rohingya ethnic cleansing in 2016-17. So they have called for observance of the ASEAN Charter principles, such as the rule of law, democracy. And we also have one last type of reaction that is interesting because it shows the range of the of consequences that this coup might entail in the region. And that is Philippines. The Philippines, the presidential committee, the presidential cabinet, sorry, has expressed the same position as China, namely this coup is only internal affairs of Burma. And they have stated that the Philippine military will never stage a similar coup at home, since President Rodrigo Duterte, has their full support. So the Philippine reaction shows that many regimes in the region might feel some sort of chain reactions due to this coup in Myanmar, which might threaten the stability of some regimes in the region.
Okay, very interesting. Now, it's worth noting, of course, this is not the first time that Myanmar has been subjected to such a coup by its generals. I believe there's been two major times in the past, 1962 and then just after the 888 uprisings. Are there any sort of links between these previous coups and this one here? Or is it very much a unique situation that just happened to be pushed by the generals currently in charge?
Well, actually, it's quite interesting because the 888 uprising, so in August the 8th, 1988, was pretty much the same thing, since after this uprising, the National League for Democracy was founded, partly founded by Aung San Suu Kyi once she returned to Myanmar. And during some elections in 1988 or 1989, the military overthrew once again, rejected the result of these elections, which showed massive support for the National League for Democracy. And it is interesting because it's that process which led to Aung San Suu Kyi's imprisonment, 15 years out of 21, from 1989 onwards. And after this coup, it led the military to progressively draft the 2008 constitution in order to show that Myanmar was on the way, was headed for democracy. And it is precisely this constitution that is at stake for the military after this, after the last November's election. Because if we take a look at Myanmar's constitution, it requires that a quarter of the seats are devolved to the military, and constitutional amendments require 75% plus one vote in order to have the constitution amended. And this is something that frightened the military, because Aung San Suu Kyi's and the NLD's massive victory, landslide victory, last November, made them afraid that this legal setting might not be enough to retain their decades-long power after this win.
Hey, I see. So it's definitely, it's almost, would you go so far as to say it's almost a symptomatic issue of the power of the military in Myanmar, noting how it's been so powerful over the years? A structural, I'm going to say.
It could be regarded as structural because, in fact, the military have, as the last election showed, they enjoy very little popularity in Myanmar regarding the population. And especially regarding the international community, the military, which had been engaged by great powers in order to cut off sanctions and help Myanmar achieve and reach a democratic state. This military lost its prestige after the ethnic cleansing of the Rohingya. And so it clearly shows that it's a sort of desperate attempt to retain its power at home, and that it has lost all, apart from China and Russia, perhaps, it has lost any possibility for international help after this coup.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, however, you say other than Russia or China, it's lost all help. China is already a significant investor. I believe the second largest investor in Myanmar, only behind Singapore. And of course, Myanmar is a key part of the Belt and Road Initiative, borders China significantly. And this is going to be a big aspect. So what really can those who oppose the fact of this coup do to shape this more from where we're speaking, of course? What can Europeans do to show their displeasure at the coup and potentially pressure the generals to hold new elections?
It's something that is quite tricky because obviously the first reaction to this kind of coup is the use of economic sanctions. Nevertheless,
A staple of European action.
Exactly, and same goes for the United States.
Easy.
And as a matter of fact, many commentators deem it a useless policy because trade between the EU and Myanmar is not that important. Although the EU accounts for 11% of the country's total trade, the military already has many assets that can be backed by China, for instance, because what we have to take into account is that after the Rohingya crisis in 2016-2017, Myanmar sort of the European Union and the United States considerably pared down their economic ties with Myanmar as a retortion measure, and that drove Myanmar to China's economic sphere of interest, and it considerably there was an upswing in economic investments by China in Myanmar. So economic sanctions would not be that effective, although some commentators think it would be interesting to precisely target what the military elicits a lot of money from. For instance, that would economic sanctions could bear upon jewels such as ruby or jade. That is an important economic resource for the military. But I do not believe that the use of economic sanctions would be that useful due to what I've just said. And we always find ourselves in front of the same position, is that we have two divided camps, and that within the international community that is rejecting, the part of the international community that is rejecting this coup, we also find some divisions. So I think that unity on part of this international community could be highly important, and that the EU could try and expand it. I mean, for the EU to really have influence over Myanmar and over this coup, it needs to improve and extend its involvement in the region. And what this crisis also shows regarding the EU is that its involvement in Asian affairs is not as important as it should be. And because of that, the EU cannot have truly, cannot truly weigh in this crisis, I believe.
That's indeed a shame, I think, yes. coming to almost full circle there, the fact that there's not really too much influence there. Picking up on what you said earlier, there is, of course, a state of emergency. And yes, it is a tried and tested mechanism to have a state of emergency be extended. It's been known for decades before in other countries. When does it currently run out, or is it indeterminate?
The state of emergency is due for 1 year. And once it expires, a year-long state of emergency, correct? And once it expires, the military has currently pledged to hold what it calls free and fair elections. But what is really troublesome in this 1 year long state of emergency is that the having free and fair elections implies that the military will accept whatever results come out of this election. And so it implies that we cannot expect the National League for Democracy's support in the population to considerably wane during this year-long state of emergency, quite the contrary. So it somehow implies that the military will use all the all its legal apparatus to curb the National League for Democracy's possibility in taking part of, in this election.
Mm-hmm. It's almost a catch-22. The military will only accept an election that's free and fair by their conditions. However, an election that's free and fair by outside conditions is not going to be acceptable by the military.
Exactly, because it's somehow how it works, how things work in Myanmar since 2008, because the constitution was drafted by the military. And they, one way of interpreting this coup is that the constitution that they drafted is no longer that efficient to protect the rights of the military that were enshrined in the constitution that they have themselves written. And so that clearly shows, this is the catch-22 situation that you mentioned. It clearly shows how politics work in Myanmar. It's this path towards democracy is only the path towards the conditions of the military and the perpetuation of their own power, in fact.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's rather disturbing, I have to admit. Is there any situation you believe that actors in the area who support the junta, so for example, China, might change their opinions? Or do you believe they're quite firmly solidified in their support?
I hardly think that China will change its position regarding the Myanmar coup, because in fact they can draw many gains out of the military staying in power a bit longer due to the investments that already exist. And I believe that China's stance today is clearly that of defending what it calls multilateralism and non-interference against the United States, that it accuses of violating these principles. Obviously, this stance has to be qualified because there are many examples of China casually violating the very principle it claims to defend. I guess that's what you could cynically call international relations.
It's hardly the only actor to do so.
Exactly. But I really doubt that China will sort of amend this position because there's too much at stake. The overarching interest for China in Myanmar is to have another way to channel the fuel imports, for instance, that come from the Middle East, that so they can arrive at the Kaukou port in Myanmar in order to avoid the Malacca Strait, which is a highly dangerous and strategic region.
I see. Yes, for geopolitical enthusiasts there, that's obviously owing the fact that it can go straight from the Sea of Bengal to China, essentially southern China too, which is one of the most important areas of growth.
Exactly, especially the province of Yunnan, precisely. And so you see there's too much at stake for China to sort of bet on a political change or bet on San Suu Kyi to recover, because China needs stability in order to carry out this project. And I would just add that this important port that we mentioned, the Kyalku port that China needs in Myanmar, is in the Rakhine state.
Wow, okay.
Which is the state where there is the where the Rohingya crisis has been going on since 2016. And so the military is obviously the one of the leading actors in this horrendous humanitarian crisis. And so there's too much at stake here to for China to follow the United States or the EU's position on this and question the stability that the, because the true stability is not the democratic evolution of the regime since 2010, 2011. It is the power of the military since 1962. That's what you'd call Myanmar's stability, even though it's what we might call as well a paradox of stability and instability. But that's, I think that's how China views this crisis nowadays.
I want to build off that by an interesting report by Rusi recently on looking at the analysis of Chinese newspapers and their response to it. And whilst there have been very much the mirroring, China Daily using the term government reshuffle, there was actually a surprising amount of pushback on this. As you may know, or as the listeners maybe don't know, there were frequent meetings between I do not pronounce her name nearly as well as you do.
Aung San Suu Kyi.
Aung San Suu Kyi, and the foreign minister. Of course, Myanmar is very important for other areas of resources, and Aung San Suu Kyi has worked with the Chinese very heavily with this. So, as you say, it's very much a marriage of convenience for now. If the pressure was to be dialed up further, would you see other actors getting involved? I know that India, for example, has sort of joined the gravely concerned calls along with Bangladesh. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most likely avenue for change?
Well, I really don't know because, for instance, you mentioned some other actors that might try and weigh heavily in this. I can think of Thailand, for instance.
Mm-hmm. We were going to get our Thai board member here, and Apisa, to join us on this talk, but sadly she's busy. But maybe we'll get her feedback later on that. Please continue.
Because, yes, you see, there are many, I think it amounts to millions of Myanmar migrants in Thailand due to, internal ethnic clashes in Myanmar. And so Thailand is not obviously in the same position as Bangladesh is with the Rohingya. Nevertheless, I think that this also explains why Thailand shares the same position as China. Namely, it absolutely wants to avoid any further collapse that could lead to an increase in ethnic clashes in Myanmar and thus potentially increase regional migrations that would directly affect Thailand due to the border that it shares with Myanmar. So I believe that the position that the biggest actors will try and have prevail in this crisis is that of stability, even if it comes at the expense of the democratically elected regime of Myanmar. They wouldn't want to support any movement that might cause further instability in an already shaken country.
Okay, thank you. Did we already briefly touch on the United States' response for that matter? I know that Blinken obviously put out the calls, but the new incoming regime, regime in the US is notably more aggressive against these kind of actions than the previous Trump administration.
Well, actually, the US has promised that it would take actions. Mm-hmm. It has called for the release of all those that were detained by the military. And, many people expect that new sanctions will be implemented. But there are some limits to this because, firstly, many Myanmar generals have already been economically sanctioned due to the Global Magnitsky Act.
Rohingya.
Yes, due to the Rohingya crisis and then the 2019 Magnitsky Act. For instance, they're barred from entering the US. They cannot hold assets in the country or do business with American citizens. So as I mentioned, some observers think that there is a possibility of a renewed ban on ruby or jade imports. But American investments in Myanmar are quite low in 2020. I think the figures are $135 million that were given by the US to Myanmar. And so, and within these $135 million, little of that could be affected by sanctions, since most of it went to NGOs. So, American response might be difficult, and then again, all the more difficult as it would directly pit the US against China, another area of confrontation between those two.
I see. Not easy then. I believe that I think we can conclude that it's definitely been caught in a true web of geopolitics, really. It's one of those situations where it's literally between actors in about as direct way as you can make it.
It's a complex, an intricate web of geopolitics. I completely agree. But if we have to have a faint glimmer of hope, I think it comes then again from the civil population and civil reactions, because they're quite akin to civil movements in Thailand. Because these movements are based upon non-violence. They continue in spite of the regime's water cannoning, and it's been going on for 3 or 4 days, where millions of Myanmar citizens have got to the streets and protested against the regime. So, in spite of the internet blocking and so on, and so I think that due to the National League for Democracy and Aung San Suu Kyi's popularity in the country, the civil population and especially the youth have too much to lose to stop demonstrating. And it clearly shows that there is a faint glimmer of hope that this coup will not be met with merely submission on the part of the population.
I think that's quite a positive way to end the podcast, to be honest. This week was quite a short podcast. Obviously, it was only Timothy and myself. But this was sort of an example of the kind of topics and discussions we'll be debating in the EU Asia Pacific Chair of Studies. Are there any other final comments you want to make, or sort of shout outs for that matter, of what projects you'll be working on the upcoming chair?
Well, the projects will be coming up will be firstly a sort of wide study of the Indo-Pacific policies in the European Union. And we're planning on having some other podcasts. I would like some about, for instance, the European Union's relation with all the what can be regarded as small Pacific islands, or the EU's links with Australia or New Zealand. So that would be something we're going to be working on. And yes, the Indo-Pacific in order to kickstart our chair.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Timothée, for joining us.
Thank you, Philippe.
All the way from Paris, by the way, I believe, which we did mention at the beginning. And we'll probably hear from you in the future as well. But yeah, thank you very much. Thank you all for listening. This has been a shorter episode of our Great European Talks this week. We'll be recording a few more podcasts in the upcoming weeks. Look out for a podcast with Sven Biskup, Professor Sven Biskup, on his upcoming book on geopolitics and other podcasts to come. All that's left is to just tell you to stay safe, stay healthy, and keep an eye out on our social media for any of our other events and podcasts. That's obviously the Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, and all your various social media needs. Have a good day. Have a good week. Goodbye, all.